It's Insight on PRN, Progressive Radio Network. My name is Mark Farrell. Good Thursday morning to you. 9/11/2014. New York City turned 350 the other day. And of course, New York City and the world changed 13 years ago. We're going to be talking about that today. On a very, very, very different and lighter note, as I drink my hot beverage here, here's a visual for you. How would you like to have a pumpkin spice condom? So either you just turned up the device you're listening to PRN.FM with, or you just clicked off. Yeah, Durex Condoms is coming out with a pumpkin spice condom, because why not? You should have your pumpkin spice latte accompanied with a condom that tastes very similar. Okay, let's get that thought right out of our minds. So what do you think? NFL Commissioner Goodell? Should he get the boot? I think so. Come on now. Trying to appoint a former FBI lead to investigate what actually happened, proving what they're saying, that they did not know that video existed. The video that was taken from inside the elevator of Ray Rice pummeling his then fiancée. I don't think there's any question in my mind. First of all, I think Ray Rice should have been booted prior to this whole thing starting. I mean, right from the get-go, he should have been ousted. Violence, you know, what a precedent they're setting. Violence on the field's one thing, but off the field, you have millions and millions of kids looking up to these stars, and adults as well, unfortunately. And you have to set the precedent. But they're also saying that if Ray Rice is ousted, totally from the league, forever, banned forever, that there's a few other players that are not being persecuted to the degree Ray Rice is, but also have charges and are still pending abuse charges. Domestic violence is no joke. It's very rampant. And what I've been reading a lot lately is how everyone is saying, poor Ray Rice's wife. And what about Ray Rice? That's where the problem lies. They're saying, well, why didn't she leave him? Why would she put up with that? And we all kind of know the one-on-one psychology behind that. Something in her childhood, her father used to possibly abuse her mother, etc. But Ray Rice, the men in the world, the abusers, why are not more of the media, why isn't more of the media paying more attention to that, rectifying the problem? I mean, there are some same-sex marriages, men and ladies, where abuse exists as well. That's a whole nother topic right there. That's a show right there. So stay tuned. We're going to have to investigate that. So if you're feeling like a slacker, a little lethargic, maybe you're a couch potato, far from athletic, well, this is going to add to it. Would you believe a 16-year-old girl completed the Triple Crown Open Water Swim? I never heard of such a thing, but it exists. So Charlotte Samuels swam around the island of Manhattan, the beautiful island of Manhattan. I think it's about a 12-mile swim because the island is 2 by 12, I think. So maybe between 12 and 15 miles. Then she swam the Catalina Channel in California, and then she topped off the Triple Crown Open Swim by completing the English Channel Swim in only a mere 20 hours and 44 minutes. So she has earned herself the title of the 3 open water swims and also the youngest. And there was an individual that she swam with. I don't have his name in front of me. Who was the oldest gentleman to swim the English Channel. 70-something years old, heart surgeon, and he did it. Wow, what would possess somebody to do something of that caliber? Jeez, I don't know, man. That's not something that I would consider doing. I mean, I'm an athlete, and I like to do endurance events. But the biggest thing I've ever done are triathlons and marathons. And triathlons run the gamut. They can be as short as a half-mile swim, quarter-mile swim, actually. Excuse me. That pumpkin spice latte is lingering. Don't get that visual in your mind from Dora-X. No. Clear your brain. But no, I just couldn't fathom doing something so that required such endurance, physical and psychological. I mean, the temperature of the English Channel alone is very, very daunting. Yesterday, I had the pleasure of speaking at Rutgers University. They were taking part in World Suicide Prevention Day. And we're going to be talking about that later today. We have a guest who's going to be coming on the show, Major General Mark Graham, who is in charge of several of the programs there, a director at Rutgers. And unfortunately, I did not have a chance to meet him yesterday when I spoke on this panel for National Suicide Prevention Day. But he was in D.C. doing his legislative work, and I was there. Now I'm in New York City, and he's back in his office in New Brunswick, New Jersey. But we do have him on the show. But it was a very interesting day because the theme of World or International Suicide Prevention Day was hope and support. How do you tie those two together? So that's what my theme was, talking to individuals, professionals, a lot of first responders there. I shared my experience with losing my brother to suicide 22 years ago, and also my experience with anxiety and depression. What got me through it? What helped me persevere, be resilient, etc. Great individuals doing some phenomenal cutting-edge work. And I also had a tour of the facility, multiple call lines they have in there. Hope Line, state and national peer support lines. So we're going to be talking about that in the second half of the show. And you're going to find it quite interesting. There's so many individuals that are really, really determined to change the stigma of mental health, mental illness, and also to find new ways to really reduce the number of suicides nationally and internationally. 13 years ago today, and it seems like it was yesterday, I was mere blocks away from the Trade Center, where I broadcasted for another radio station, CD 101.9, on Houston, West Houston and Varick Street. And it was a day I'll never forget. I actually lived in Hoboken at the time, and when I was getting into the train to come into Manhattan, I saw one of the towers ablaze. And I just couldn't fathom, on such a clear day, how could a small plane not see such a behemoth structure? Never dawned on me that someone would purposefully fly into a tower. So by the time I got to the surface, on the New York side, things have changed. Things had changed drastically. So, and the world changed drastically that day. And so that particular moment, I don't think I left my workplace for 48 or 72 hours. It was really hard to get in and out of. Not that I chose or wanted to leave. There weren't many of my colleagues who were broadcasting on the air able to get into the city. Obviously, there was sheer pandemonium. Tunnels, bridges, everything were locked down solid. So I did what any and most New Yorkers knew what to do, was just pitch in and help. Stayed on the air for hours after hours. Walked around. Actually, one of the first things I tried to do is give blood at a nearby hospital that is actually shut down on 14th Street in Greenwich Village in the last year and a half. And I got to the line. I said, hey, listen, I'd like to donate some blood. And they said, actually, we don't need any right now. Our supply is full. But we're expecting a lot of casualties. Triage is set up over there. We're expecting any minute, any hour, in the next several hours, hordes and hordes of injured people from the Trade Center and responders to be brought here. But unfortunately, that wasn't the case. So I turned back around, went to the radio station, and I looked around and people were just huddled around radios. Brought me back to like the 70s, where car radios were just blaring, doors were open, And you could tell strangers were just huddled around cars just to get news and information. So I immediately called up the radio station and said, hey, listen, let's go live. And we did. And I gave the report of what I felt, how palpable the fear and tragedy and the unknown was on the street at that time. Never forget that. It's actually Dwayne Reed that I pass still to this day that I used a landline phone on that worked, surprisingly. And just getting the feeling from people, just from reading their faces. I do remember later that day trying to go out, hours later, this is maybe 4 or 5 o'clock that day, trying to go out and get a bite to eat at the local deli and bring some food back for my colleagues. And this guy was running down the street, wasn't paying too much attention to him, and all of a sudden he got clipped by a car. Not like a major, you know, clip, but enough where he got thrown a few feet, car stopped. He rolled, came to a stop, stood up, looked dazed, and continued to run. So I was right there where he fell and rolled and stood up again. I said to him, hey, buddy, buddy, come here. Stop, stop, stop. Hey, let me check you out. Sit down. Let's sit down. Take a breath. Let me check you out. He just looked back at me. And he had that look in his eye, just like every other New Yorker had, that said, I can't stop. I have to be somewhere. I have to find someone. So events like that really underscored what people were feeling. One of my best friends when in college and after college worked at an insurance company in one of the towers. And I spoke to his wife earlier that day and said, hey, listen, if you speak to Harry Blanding, make sure you tell him to come to the radio station. He can hang out here. You know, I'm so close. He can make himself at home. When I went out, when I just told you I went out to get a sandwich, I told the secretary, the receptionist at the front of the radio station, I said, hey, if a buddy of mine comes up named Harry, he was down at the World Trade Center, please let him in, you know, make himself comfortable, etc. All day long, kept waiting for Harry to show up. And I knew Harry would come to the radio station because everyone was walking north on the island. Why wouldn't Harry? Harry never showed up that day or the following day. Harry made his way out into the elevator with his colleagues. Then his boss apparently said to him, hey, Harry, I need you. Can you give me a hand? Harry, the most gregarious and affable and giving person that I know, obliged, stepped out of the elevator. And that was the last that we know of Harry. So he left behind a dear wife and 3 incredibly sweet children. Like many, many people, lost several family members, friends, colleagues. An indelible day that will never, ever be erased from our minds. It's one of those things that it's permanently etched in our minds. 30 years from now, it'll be the same feeling like as if it were yesterday. Today, I think people are on edge. The city's a little bit quieter, understandably, with all the threats ensuing. But that doesn't stop people from coming and doing what they want to do. Let life continue. But still pausing to remember the significance of the day. There was an organization that was founded post 9/11 by one of the co-founders who actually lost his brother, who was a first responder. His partner is joining me today on the phone. He's a co-founder of the 9/11 National Day of Service and Remembrance Foundation. And the goal of the 9/11 Day is to provide a positive way for all people to forever remember and pay tribute to the 9/11 victims, honor those that rose in service in response to the attacks, and remind people of the importance of working more closely together in peace to improve our world. And I remember certain acts of kindness I would see for weeks and months afterwards. And then I remember somebody telling me that they saw something, some person acted just ridiculous, like, you know, pre-9/11. And then someone stood up in the train and said, well, I guess the period of acting nice to our fellow neighbors is gone. Anyway, I'd like to welcome David Payne to the show. David, how are you?
Hi, good morning. How are you? And thanks for having me on your show today.
Great pleasure, my friend. Well, this is something that's probably part of your DNA, paying it forward from what I've seen and read of you.
It kind of is. I mean, I'm probably a hopeless idealist.
Join the club, my friend.
Think that of me. And I, you know, after seeing 9/11, happen, I was of course stunned by the tragedy, but I also will never forget, like, you know, just as you mentioned, the way the country changed for a fleeting moment. You know, that the fact that we looked at each other differently. We were all neighbors all of a sudden. It didn't matter whether you knew a person or not, and you know, we stopped worrying about, you know, whether I was, you know, you or I were a Republican or a Democrat, you know, all those kinds of things, race, color, creed, all of that just immediately dissolved because we were all unified by, you know, our horror, you know, sense of horror in the tragedy. And for a period of time then, you know, we had this glimpse of what the world could be like if we worked a little more closely together. And for me, that was the inspiration for starting the day because I thought, well, okay, you know, this has been a terrible tragedy, but maybe in tribute, we can find a way to rekindle that sense of to the togetherness and compassion at least one day out of the year. And that's really what the 9/11 day is all about, to do all of that in tribute and in remembrance of those that were lost and the many that rose in service.
And, of course, your partner, Jay Winnick, I guess you approached him and he was immediately probably awed by the idea because he lost his brother, who was a first responder, and certainly wouldn't want that memory to wane.
Yeah, Jay, you know, he and I had been, you know, colleagues and work for many, many years. And although I didn't know him all that well, I knew his family. And when I found out that he'd lost his brother, Glenn, Glenn, by the way, was an attorney who worked downtown in New York City at Holland and Knight. But he was also a trained volunteer firefighter and a rescue EMT. And he ran into the South Tower to help, like a lot of heroes did. And unfortunately, he was lost when the building collapsed. And they found his remains about 6 months later with a barred medic kit by his side. You know, he was a hero, and he was a giving person. And, you know, we both felt that he would like the idea that the country was paying tribute to him by serving. But we also spent a lot of time talking to so many other family leaders and friends who lost loved ones, and we said, even before we got started, you know, what do you think of this idea? Does this seem like the right way of paying tribute? And overwhelmingly, everyone said, yes, let's do this. Let's make sure that, you know, 20, 30, 50 years from now, we are still remembering and we're doing it through the kindness of our acts.
Now, it's reported that in 2013, more than 47 million people throughout the U.S. and 150 countries observe 9/11 by performing good deeds that helped others. How is that measured?
Well, you know, we don't do it ourselves. We ask a research company, Horizon Consumer Science, to do surveys and polls after 9/11 every year. And it's been remarkable to us as well to see that it's grown, because the 10-year anniversary of 9/11, we had about 33 million people participate. That was remarkable. In fact, that was the largest day of service in U.S. history up until that point. So we all thought, Jay and I thought, that it would probably gradually decline a little bit because it wasn't a 10-year anniversary. That's been the opposite. We've actually seen continued growth. So now there are more people than ever doing it, and it's really beginning to take hold as, you know, as an aspect of the fabric of the country, and it's transforming the way we think about 9/11. And I like that because I don't want the terrorists to win. Like, I don't want my children and their children and their children to only know that 9/11 is a day of, think of 9/11 as a day of tragedy, mm-hmm. of what these, you know, terrible people did to us. Now what's happening is it's being more defined by the goodness that people are showing every day through their service.
We have a good point that I believe is probably the case, David, that maybe the children of a lot of the people who were lost are at the age now where they can contribute. I think as it's been declared Patriot Day, I think that it's more of a semblance of obviously what took place, but also a day of hope, of not forgetting, and today a day to pay it forward. And so I think you hit the nail on the head when you started this organization, because There were so many people, myself included, that didn't know what to do, wanted to do something, and didn't have an outlet. I mean, they were turning people away at food donation sites, clothing sites, etc. And so what could people do? There's nothing tangible. There was nothing, because obviously so many people were lost, unless you're a responder, can go down there in the bucket brigade. But now there is and has been a way for people to get involved and stay involved.
You know, it's been a great healing experience for a lot of people individually and the country. You know, I work with so many, you know, relatives of people who lost their lives. And, you know, I actually had a woman who lost her husband say to me that she actually feels like the way the country is now paying tribute through service is a blessing that's come out of 9/11. It's, for her, it's the only thing that she sees as positive.
True.
But she says it makes it a lot easier for her to wake up in the morning every 9/11 and look at her children and at least be able to say to her two, you know, now teenage sons, you know, yes, your dad, you know, was killed, but look at how the country is paying tribute to him. And I know as a person, you know, Jay lost someone. I did not. But I feel the same way that you do, which is that it makes me feel like I'm doing something, that the terrorists aren't winning, that I'm able to cope with it in this positive way. And in aggregate, when you think about everybody in the country doing this, mm-hmm. I think it's helping us get past the day but not forget the day, and that's the important thing.
And tell me about the President's Call to Service Award.
Well, I had, you know, Jay and I, for the last, you know, decade, we volunteered 100% of our time to this, and then I left my, you know, my business to dedicate myself full time to this, and so between us, I don't know how many thousands of volunteer hours we put into it, and we don't care about awards at all, neither one of us.
Sure.
But somebody had, I think the Bush administration had recognized some of the things we had been contributing to the day, and we were recognized for it, which certainly, you know, is a wonderful thing. But to me, the award that I get is what I've been seeing today. I mean, I'm down in Washington, D.C. at a charter school, and we're installing a playground here. The school doesn't have the money to have a playground, and these are little kids that don't get enough time to play. And these are all these volunteers. There's over 300 of them, and they're all working and contributing their time. And to me, that's the greatest award I could ever get.
I love it. Fantastic. Now, you're based out in California. On a day like this, 9/11, across the country, what is the temperature like there? Do people have a sense of what happened, and do they kind of take pause like we do here?
Well, yes. I mean, this is absolutely a national phenomenon, and I think it's understandable that it would be, because you didn't have to be in New York or Washington or, you know, Shanksville, mm-hmm. Pennsylvania, to be a victim. I mean, you felt
sure.
I mean, you might. I was in California when it happened, and I felt victimized because I couldn't help. I mean, all I could do was watch it on television, and so people all around the country, it doesn't make a difference where they are, Florida, Texas, you know, Ohio, everywhere in the country, I think they continue to feel a need that it's important for them to pay tribute, because it helps to deal with the way they felt, the sense of helplessness back then. So I've seen all around the country, you know, this remarkable outpouring of support. We have a sort of an online national tribute going, happening right now, where people are tweeting and posting on Facebook messages of support and their good deeds. And they're using the hashtag 911 day, and we're one of the top trending topics worldwide right now. There's millions of people posting these tweets. So what that says to me is that it's not just even a domestic phenomenon; it's becoming an international one for good reason. I mean, people from 92 countries were killed on 9/11.
Hey, David, state that hashtag once again, slowly.
Yeah, so it's hashtag 911 day.
Day,
like
okay.
D-A-Y.
Gotcha.
Yeah, just all, yeah. So anyone who's out there listening who wants to kind of participate, all they have to do is go to Twitter or Facebook and post a message of support, a good deed or a prayer, and just finish it with a hashtag 911 day. And then we'll pick it up and we'll see it. And we're actually, favoriting some of those and retweeting them. And a lot of them are appearing on our website, 911day.org, right now. So if they go to 911day.org, they'll be able to share those messages also through Twitter or Facebook. So
and the videos that you have,
that's probably the best place to go.
The videos you have that live on your website are very powerful, very well done.
You know, they're wonderful videos because they're true.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we had a company donate time, and they went out and they interviewed Americans all around the country, just asking what they remember about 9/11 and what they're going to do in tribute. And it's just a great, you know, short little 60-second video. We have a lot of teachers that are using it in class today, you know, to try to explain 9/11 to younger children, some who weren't even born yet, about what happened, but do it in a non-threatening way. So it's been a great tool.
Well, I have a five-year-old who just started kindergarten the other day, and he was asked to wear red, white, and blue today. My wife and I were explaining that it's Patriot Day. And he goes, what is Patriot Day? And it was just, we didn't have the timing and we didn't pre-discuss this. But during this conversation, I'm thinking about, obviously, and you have three children, that this is something that, you know, when they get older, they need to understand the realities. And he knows that there are good people in this world and bad people in this world. But segueing to the next part of this is that you do have three children. Are they like, oh, Dad, the good Dieter, the Dudley Do-Right's doing right again? Or is this obviously you're being a tremendous role model for them to emulate as they get old?
Well, I would say in the first few years, I think they had no idea.
Sure.
You know, and you know, I'm sure, and everybody looked at me a little bit like they looked at Don Quixote.
Yeah, exactly.
I was absolutely chasing a windmill in the mind of a lot of people. But I think that's changed now. You know, my kids absolutely believe in this, and I've had my sons and daughter at service projects with me now. They really do believe in the day. I noticed that they were sharing tweets and their own messages also today. So I won them over.
Good for you. Good for you.
I feel pretty good about that. Yeah.
Do you ever get people say to you, well, this is great. I love your organization. I love the mission. I love how it was given birth, well, in a positive way, but I want to do more than that. Can I do something every day or once a week or once a month, et cetera? And do you tie them into your organization and or connect them with others?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we try to do that as best as we can.
Because obviously, you know, people, especially in this economy that, you know, they have some downtime. And one of the things that is recommended is that you fulfill your downtime when you're not looking for jobs is volunteerism, because it's obviously very rewarding. And why not give it in a discipline or platform which obviously can make you feel very good, and certainly if it's in the confines of 9/11, and that would fulfill that void.
You know, there's a lot of veterans who come back from, you know, overseas that have turned to, you know, service, national service, and community service as a way to kind of deal with, you know, the transition that they go through, because they want to feel like they're contributing and making a difference, and especially having gone through what they've all had to go through. You know, service is a great transitional moment, but it's also helpful, as you say, for people that may not be working, that, you know, just looking to make sure that they're continuing to feel good about themselves and contribute, which service does provide. Mark, unfortunately, I have to go and run and lift, apparently.
Totally understand, David.
A giant table and move it at this project I'm at, and they're waving
me
over.
That's your contribution for this hour. David Payne, thank you so much. Name your website again, please.
911day.org, so 911day.org.
Thank you for your great work. All the best to you.
All right, you take care.
This has been Insight. My name is Mark Farrell. That was David Payne. He is the co-founder of the 9/11 National Day of Service and Remembrance, which is the goal of 9/11 Day is to provide a positive way for all people to forever remember and pay tribute to 9/11 victims. And it doesn't matter whether it was in New York City, Pennsylvania, or in Boston. We'll return after this, and you'll meet Major General Mark Graham from Rutgers University right after this. All right, welcome back. My name is Mark Farrell. This show is Insight on PRN.FM, the Progressive Radio Network. Right before the break, I mentioned the three sites, crash sites, and I was erroneously mentioned Boston. I was thinking about where one of the planes actually left. I meant to say D.C., so my mistake there. I apologize for that. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888 is the number here at PRN. Podcasts are always available at prn.fm. Click on the Insight page And this show and all past shows are available for you anytime, 24/7, 365. For all the people who are insomniacs or can't get enough of any program here on PRN.FM. Yesterday, I was invited to partake in a great day. Well, it's a great day. We wish we didn't have to have a day like this. World Suicide Prevention Day, hosted by Rutgers in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Great college, great town. And I was part of a panel. And the theme of the panel, or actually I should say of World Suicide Prevention Day, is hope and support. So I spoke about how I felt that resiliency and hope are sort of synonymous terms. And obviously I spoke for a great time and I can't go into details right now, but that a lot of people just really feel and lose hope when they are depressed. Mental illness robs you of that. My brother, who took his life 22 years ago, obviously didn't think that he would be able to survive, that this, you know, inner demon was stronger than he was. And then I experienced depression, anxiety, etc. But I never lost that hope. I even had fears of, you know, taking my life. But it was weird, as I think we're wired differently, that I never lost hope, even in my darkest day. I said to myself, I know I will get through this. I know if I can get through this day, I can get through tomorrow and the following day. Lots of work, mind you, lots of work. And the days that were 24 hours seemed like they were 48 hours long. Anyway, so this panel yesterday was fantastic. And there was a gentleman there who runs one of the divisions. His name is Major General Mark Graham. We actually did not have the pleasure of meeting each other yesterday because he was in Washington, D.C., I'm sure working on some pressing legislation. He's a senior director of the Rutgers National Call Center and also director of the Military Veteran and Family Support Services. And at this time, I'd like to welcome Major Graham to the show.
Yeah, hi, Mark. Thanks very much for having me on. I appreciate it. And first, I just want to say I'm sorry for the loss of your brother.
Thank you. Thank you. And I'm sorry for the loss of two sons of yours. One, unfortunately, due to being in the wrong place at the wrong time, a roadside bomb. And a couple of years back, was that 2008, General?
No, we lost our son, Kevin, to suicide in June of 2003. And then our oldest son, Jeff, was killed by an IED in Iraq. He was in the Army. He was a second lieutenant. He was killed while he was on foot patrol in February of 2004. So we lost both our sons within 8 months.
Within 8 months. So nothing more in life has rocked your world than that.
Correct.
How did you get into that? Obviously catapulted you prior to losing both sons. How involved were you in the mental health field in the service in the Army?
Well, I'm a career artillery officer. So I'm a field artilleryman by trade. And then as you move up to the senior ranks, you kind of get more generalized, if you will. And so I wasn't involved in mental health other than, you know, you're involved in everything when you're in command.
Mm-hmm.
So as the leader, you're in charge of whatever's going on, and you're on the installation that you're in charge of or the unit you're in charge of. So after we lost our son, certainly after we lost Kevin, we didn't know much about mental health. You know, I didn't realize you could die from being too sad. And our son was sad, and we knew it. And we then later knew he had some depression. We didn't know much about it 11 years ago. So we've kind of taken up that mantra that we our son and daughter, our other son and Jeff, and then our daughter Melanie had both encouraged my wife and I to help speak out because mm-hmm. we had to do something with our grief.
Sure.
To help others, and we didn't want Kevin's loss to go without helping other people. Kevin wanted to be a doctor. He was going to be an Army doctor, and he took his life. Was on medication for depression and came off the medication because he didn't want the military to know he was on medication.
Pretty common.
It is. And the stigma is still out there. I do think we're making progress. One of the things that helps is shows just like this that help people understand that no one wants mental illness, just like no one wants cancer or any kind of other illness or disease. No one wants it, and it's not a character flaw. But the stigma keeps people from getting help and seeking help and talking about it because they don't want people to think of him as weak. And I think our son felt he was weak. And I think, frankly, my wife and I were part of the stigma. We didn't understand it and was like, oh, not our son. You know, he couldn't have, you know, depression. And he's a straight-A student, going to be a doctor, and he's, you know, going to be in the Army. And we just want to help other people know. One is there is hope out there if you're struggling with mental illness. We had it on both sides of our families and didn't know it because no one ever talked about it. You talk about everything else at the kitchen table.
Absolutely.
But we don't talk about this. It's kind of the thing you don't speak about, and we've got to speak about it.
In the service, is there literature, propaganda, et cetera, that is disseminated to servicemen about mental health?
They do. They get it. It's more it's certainly better now than it used to be. It's continues to get better. Actually, in some in the services, they're working now to try to put behavioral health professionals at lower levels. Because previously, before, there's a shortage of them, as you know, certainly nationwide, but at the hospital. And now they're working to get additional behavioral health personnel so that they can have them at a lower level so they have better access and easier access to care. For the service members, which will also help assist in reducing the stigma of going to see someone. You know, no one says a thing when you go see the doctor. No one says a thing when you go see the dentist. No one says a thing when you go see the chaplain. So why should they say something if you go to see a mental health professional?
Absolutely.
But we do still because of the stigma. So we're getting there, but it's just taking a lot longer than any of us wanted to take.
So certainly this really, really, I mean, hit home in the worst of fashions. But being a 35-year veteran in the service, you probably have dealt with many losses. Under your command.
Yeah, absolutely. And every service member or family member you lose is tragic. And regardless of the manner of death, suicide just carries so much more with it. As you well know, having lost your brother, I mean, we've had people that people tell us pretty much anything now because we're an open book and we've been through so much. Both people tend to tell us about anything. And what we found in oftentimes, more than we realize, is how many people are carrying a loss of a family member or a loved one to suicide inside, and they've either never spoken about it or they've said it was something else for years and years, and the family's just never discussed it because the family felt ashamed. And the sad part is mental health. You know, depression is treatable and it's diagnosable and treatable, and there's help for it, and there's wonderful doctors and medications, and sometimes you don't even need medication, but you need to see a professional to find out what, in fact, do you need for what you're going through.
Or possibly medication for a short period.
Absolutely, yeah. And that's the case. Some people, and one of the things our son said to us was, you know, what do I need, Mom, to be a pill on the rest of my life? And we didn't know how to answer that, but now sometimes when I speak, I tell people, I'm on blood pressure medicine every day, and no one seems to think anything about that.
Not at all.
So I think at some point we'll be at the point where we can accept it and understand that it's real. And when you look at the statistics and how many people have some form of mental illness, it's a huge number. It's just going to take time. But it's because it's the invisible wound, the invisible wound you can't see. It is so hard for people to understand. There was an Army service member that was on a television interview one time, and I'll never forget when I heard him say it. When the interviewer asked him a question about his mental illness, he responded, "I would have rather lost my leg, because then at least people would have been able to see my wound." But he had post-traumatic stress and traumatic brain injury. He goes, "But with this, no one can see why I'm like I am now."
You're perceived as weak in certain people's eyes.
Exactly right. And it was pretty profound when he said that. But
absolutely.
I thought, can you imagine saying you'd rather lose a leg? I mean, that's really shocking. So that got my attention, too. But, I mean, it's tough. And the military is working hard. They are working hard at it. I mean, they really are. They're trying. It's tough. It's a tough culture to change.
Mm-hmm.
But
sure.
Change is hard for anyone.
Absolutely.
But our nation's sure changed. You know, we lost more people. I think it was last year we lost more people to suicide than we did car accidents. But how much has our nation done for automobile safety?
Not enough.
But when I was a kid, you didn't have seatbelts. Now we've got seatbelts. We've got airbags. We've got 5 on our bumpers. We've got all kinds of safety glass. We've got all kinds of protections for vehicle safety. We're losing more to suicide than we are automobile safety. So, I mean, I think there's more we can do. I think there's a lot being done, but I think we can continue to do even more.
Major Graham is my guest. The show is Insights, PRN.FM. My name is Mark Farrell. Major Graham is the Senior Director of the Rutgers National Call Center and also Director of our Military and Veteran and Family Support Services. So, I imagine, Major, that upon retiring, you realized certainly that you had to continue to devote your life to public service, combining the military and certainly into the mental health field because of the loss of your son, Kevin. And how did you decide to go into this conduit, the exact specific field?
Well, you know, when you retired from the Army as a general officer, you try to figure out what you're going to do next. And my heart and passion was in helping others some way, continuing to serve and help others. And I didn't find for the first year and a half or so, I didn't find it. But then I got a call from Mr. Chris Kossoff, who's the president and CEO of Rutgers University of Behavioral Healthcare. And Rutgers has some peer support lines here that help others that are struggling and going through challenges. And they've added some military lines here. So he contacted me and asked me about it. It includes military members and their families. So I said, absolutely, because I've been out speaking about things we need to do, and this gave me a chance to actually do some of the things I've been saying we should do. So this allows me to kind of, if you will, you know, kind of where the rubber meets the road, and that is, you know, 24 hours a day we have people here answering the phone, helping others when they call and they're struggling. And the idea is, how do we help them before they get to the crisis point?
Absolutely. And I imagine when Robin Williams committed suicide just a few mere weeks ago, that your service phone center was lighting up like a Christmas tree.
It did. Actually, we had the New Jersey Hope line is run out of the call center here with us, and their call volume more than doubled.
What kind of numbers were that, Major Green?
I'd have to go back and check with the team that runs the program over there, but I mean, a lot of calls, you know, hundreds.
That obviously says a lot, because, number one, you must be doing the best education, because people, first of all, the numbers doubled, so that means people could find you easily.
Yeah,
and so at the fingers' touch, which is good. And what kind of training do responders and our persons who are manning the phones get? Obviously, they must be well trained to deal with people in crisis.
Yeah, those who work on the crisis line are the majority are mental health professionals.
They are okay.
So they get a lot of education, formal education. Then they get a lot of, we do training here with them, and of course they continue on, and then. As they go and get calls, they work, and they work very well as a team together. So those that have been doing this longer than others do that. But the New Jersey Hope Line, and also we're connected to the National Suicide Line 1-800-273-TALK. So we do a lot of work here to help support people in any way we can through both of those lines.
Now, this is a hypothetical scenario, but if you were back in the field, artillery officer or commanding a group, forgive me for my bad semantics of the military, but if you thought that your an individual under your command was experiencing mental illness, what would you do nowadays with all that you know?
Escort them to care.
Right away.
Don't just say, hey, you need to go see someone, but take them. You know, take them yourself. Don't tell them, hey, looks like you're having some struggles. You probably need to go see someone. I would say, hey, why don't you hop in the car? Let's go see someone, and get them to care right then. Don't wait, because it's literally life and death.
And of course, as a brother who lost a brother, and a parent who lost his son, hindsight's 20/20 right now. Obviously, we've both learned an immense amount of mental health since then, and certainly would have done things differently. I mean, unfortunately, as we both know, that if someone wants to take their life, sure, you could save them a handful of times possibly, but I mean, we hear about this day in and day out, that this happens in hospitals and institutions that are meant to keep people safe. But the education is paramount, certainly what you're involved in, and to audiences that I speak to across the country, nationally, about mental illness and my story and what I did and what helped me survive and be resilient and forge ahead. But I think, you know, as you said at the head of the interview here, that education is something that obviously continues and needs to grow. The dialogue, the conversation's been started with Robin Williams. Unfortunately, it takes so many of a great celebrity or public figure of the community to open this dialogue, but some good has to come of it.
Yeah, absolutely, and that's the way we felt of our son's death. Something good had to come from his death. And so we've started some programs on college campuses. You know, the number, depending on the study you look at, the number two or three leading cause in college-age students' deaths is suicide. So we started programs at where he went to college, University of Kentucky, and another school in Oklahoma where we used to live while I was in the Army there. So to help young people know there's a place to go, and they help make sure all their professors have some training and understanding of of the symptoms and the warning signs, and they also taught the freshman orientation to make sure the parents and the students realize if you start to see these symptoms, if you see these indicators, it's not something to take lightly. It's serious.
If there's some,
get them in and get them checked out, and let the medical professionals do what they do.
If any of the PRN listeners are listening and have pondered going into the military, whatever branch that may be, and do have a history of mental illness, what would you say to them?
If they consider them, they need to go in and see if they qualify. Because some people are concerned about it. But, you know, if you have other conditions, you're not allowed to come in the military either.
Mm-hmm.
So there are different disqualifying factors.
Sure.
And if you want to serve and you have some mental illness, you need to go in and make sure they're aware of that. And you may or may not be able to go in the military. But it's important to tell them the truth when you go in there for the interviews to see. Because if you can't go in, there's a disqualifying purpose. There's a reason for that. And so I think it's just an important one, as we want all the young Americans, that we love more and more young Americans to continue to want to serve.
Sure, sure. Now, looking past that, they get through the test, physical test, et cetera, et cetera. But the bigger question is, would they feel comfortable knowing that they have to take medication or would possibly have to take medication down the road in today's service?
With the military?
Yes.
Well, I mean, I think you'll find that there's those in the military now that take medication now and are still serving. So I think
Great. It
depends on the severity of it. I mean, it depends on the severity of
sure.
That just like it does many other things.
Mm-hmm. If they can cope and deal on a daily basis, they should be able to, have a job just like anyone else.
Absolutely. And now, and many times, of course, as you said, you don't even need medication. You just need, to see someone, a therapist or someone to talk to or a group or whatever.
Now, you hosted World Suicide Prevention Day yesterday, and the theme, as I mentioned before, was hope and support. Now, how do you connect hope and support in this applicable situation?
Well, to me, it's connectedness is a key piece, and I know you mentioned that, and that was part of yesterday's. My wife was here yesterday. I was unable to attend, but my wife
very
was
dear
here.
Lady, very lucky man.
Well, thank you. Well, I know your family as well, and wonderful folks. And connectedness is really important. But if someone starts pulling back from others, and they feel lonely, or they feel like they're lonely and they're not alone, that's a clear warning sign. So. I think the way we've continued to have hope, we have a daughter who's now a registered nurse. Actually, she's in New York City. She's a nurse in New York City. And she wanted to continue to do something for the rest of her life to help other people after losing her brothers. And she's the youngest, and she's lost both her older brothers. So our daughter gives us hope, and she married a great young man who was also in the military, and she met him when he was in the Army. And so they give us hope, but we get hope from other people and from family and friends and those in the military that have rallied around us and are there to help keep us, frankly, to help early on to give us the courage to keep on living, because, you know, it takes a toll, and we're struggling to see what was next and what was ahead, especially after losing our second son within 8 months.
I cannot fathom, General, how that would overwhelm you and your wife and your offspring daughter. And finally, that you've penned a book that's due to come out soon. And is this a story of your 35 years and obviously the last few years of serving and losing two sons?
Well, actually, the book was written by someone else. He talked to us about doing a book, and we didn't want to do the book on our own because we didn't think we could tell the larger story, the larger issue and cover like he did. He's a professional journalist named Yoki Driessen. The name of the book is The Invisible Front, Loss and Love in an Era of Endless War. It comes out here soon. And our story is woven throughout the book. So he uses our story throughout the book to cover loss and love in an era of endless war and what we're going through and the invisible front of mental illness in the military and, frankly, in society as well.
Was that cathartic for you and your wife?
We think so. we bared ourselves, and we did this for one reason. That was to help others. Our hope is that someone will read this and get help, and others will understand and help reduce the stigma and help eliminate the stigma. That people will realize that this is real, and people aren't making this up, and they're struggling, and they need to be helped and not judged, and they need good care. So that's why we did the book, is to help others, because we don't want to see anyone else die by suicide.
Fantastic. If you can give me the title of that book once again, General?
It's The Invisible Front, Loss and Love in an Era of Endless War by Yoki Driessen, Driessen.
General Graham, thank you so much for your time and your steadfast work and past for the country, and certainly for Rutgers right now, and for publishing some work that I'm sure will benefit thousands and thousands of people.
Well, Mark, thanks very much for having me on. I appreciate it.
And
thank you for your program and to all your listeners.
Cheers. All the best to you now. This is Mark Farrell. The show has been Insight, PRN.FM. This podcast is available at PRN.FM under Insight page. On this day of remembrance, United States, internationally, paved forward, as the first guest spoke about, mygooddeed.com, 9/11 International Day of Service and Remembrance. Think of someone that possibly you knew, loved, and how we can keep this a safer, more of a peaceful world. Talk to you next Thursday.